This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Malnutrition accounts for more than a third of deaths of children under five worldwide. In fact, every 9 seconds, a child somewhere in the world dies of malnutrition. This is happening, of course, in a time of relative plenty, but while 50% of the world eats, the other half is starving. This hour, we talk about why this is happening, efforts to address it, and about a connection between malnutrition on the one hand and the obesity epidemic on the other. One of the efforts to address severe malnutrition is being spearheaded by an organization headquartered in an old grist mill in downtown Matthews. That company, Manna, makes something called ready-to-use therapeutic food, and that food is saving lives. We're joined in our Spirit Square studio by Mark Moore, the co-founder and CEO of Manna Nutrition. Mark spent nearly 10 years working in eastern Uganda as a rural development worker. He also worked as an Africa specialist in the United States Senate and for a defense contractor, so he knows the world scene. Welcome to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Dr. Nancy Faye Jensen is the Dean of the College of Health and Human Services at UNC Charlotte. She is a nutrition scientist and a registered dietitian whose research focuses on populations living in poverty, obesity prevention, and gerontological nutrition. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
Your exposure, Mark, to the hunger problem, the malnutrition problem, began, I understand, when you were a teenager. You were doing missionary work in Africa, and that continued for a decade. Talk about that and what you saw.
Well, out of college, really, my wife and I and a group of friends moved to Uganda, and we lived in Uganda, in rural Uganda, for about 10 years by the time it was all over. And my wife is an RN, so there we had continual interactions with health issues and just saw, as with any Westerner who goes to a developing country, it's just such a powerful experience. And so first few years, you think you're the answer to the problems, and then after you've done it for a few years, you start to realize that there's a lot to learn there. And part of that was nutrition. Part of it was what a big impact nutrition can make.
Did it help us understand why these parts of the world continually have eating and food problems? Is it because of colonialism? Did we go in there and break up the traditional society and they can't cope? We didn't give them the tools to cope? Or is it something else at work?
Well, there's no doubt that's part of it. If you look at Africa, and you put a stripe through the middle of the Sahel region up north of the equator, is a lot like Oklahoma or New Mexico. And if you look back at our own country, back in the 1930s, we had people starving to death. And the way we fixed that is we got in and we drilled into these aquifers and we began to change our agricultural techniques. We had agricultural techniques in the 30s that were coming over from Indiana and Ohio, and as they migrated across, if you till up all the soil, you're going to, your topsoil is going to blow away. Similarly, in some of these regions of Africa, they're not in sustainable agricultural environments, some of them, the way we've drawn up the boundaries over the last 100 years. Some of them very much are. So countries like Congo, that's a political issue when you're talking about why they can't feed themselves or if they don't manage to feed themselves. But some of the countries to the north are much more like New Mexico would be here, where New Mexico is not a food-sufficient place, and we're shipping food in there.
Right. How did the work that you did in Africa out of college lead to the creation of Manna?
Well, two pieces, really. I went to stay for 3 years, and three became five, and five became more, and finally realized I needed to probably get a job somewhere. So I moved home and went to grad school. So I went to grad school in D.C., that, through various circumstances, landed me in the U.S. Senate after I graduated, and I worked for 2 years as a legislative fellow. And there I began to learn about food aid issues. So that's where my boss there, Mary Landrieu, who just recently unelected, great lady, she cared very much about children. And we were looking at children who were living in the northern part of Uganda. That was, of course, my background is Uganda, so northern part of Uganda, in that region, there's a lot of displaced children. And as we looked at them, part of it was their food insufficiency, and part of it was family issues. There's a bunch of issues around that. But that's how I kind of began to dabble in it. And then I just saw, in learning little bits about food aid and the way we do food aid, that if we could do more value-added food aid, if we could, instead of dumping large amounts of grain on people who don't need large amounts of grain. They don't need corn. A child under six doesn't need to eat a belly full of corn. They need to the right kind of lipids and fats. And And so these value-added foods that we were able to produce in the United States but weren't doing that, mm-hmm. that kind of struck me as we ought to do that.
I want to come back to that's going to be a recurring theme, the kinds of foods that we supply to these starving. We feel so good about ourselves because we send over these bags of food saying a gift from the United States. And in many cases, it is the wrong kind of food. Surely there are experts such as yourself, doctor, who advise the government on what to send. Is that not true?
Yeah,
and yet we send the wrong stuff. Why?
It is true. Well, I think part of it is cost and part of it is trying to be culturally sensitive.
And how much of it is also trying to support our farmers?
Yeah, that's a huge part of it.
So we've got a lot of corn. Let's get rid of it.
Right. So it is an economic engine for us agriculturally, and we are doing good in some regard, but we're doing some harm in others. So when food is scarce and you're providing food that really isn't appropriate for certain age groups, and what Mark was alluding to is the conditions for food preparation aren't appropriate. No clean water. How do you cook grains when the water is tainted and is not health promoting? And so this whole idea of providing the perfect food for growth and development of very young children is genius. And it's really wonderful work that's being done.
Well, let's talk about that because manna, the company name, is short. We know where it comes from biblically, but it's short for Mother Administered Nutritive Aid. And what they're administering, in your case, is something you call RUTF, Ready-to-Use Therapeutic Food. Before we talk about exactly what this is, and I have a little bag of it right here, which I will open and dip into, tell me who came up with this product.
Well, it was developed by a nutritionist, a guy named André Brion is his name, actually. They were working in labs for MSF in France. The biggest company that makes this is a French-based company now coming off of that idea. But they were taking the food. There's a stuff called therapeutic milk. It's specifically designed for kids. So they began to address these issues of giving the wrong type of food to children, and they made up this therapeutic milk. And then they don't have a way to stabilize this. I mean, if you send it to a village and it's powdered milk, then you've got to add water. You've got to have a mom who's going to mix it right, which is tough. I mean, you've
got to boil the water first.
That's right. And it's not shelf stable. So if you mix enough for that use, the next day you don't have a fridge, so you're not going to be able to mix more than what you need. So they began to stabilize it in peanut butter. And it became a very simple idea that was a revolutionary idea that really changed. It was a revolution in nutritional affairs for kids under six who need this kind of intervention, the perfect food.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get involved in producing this product?
Yeah, I heard about it when I was working there in Washington, and then leaving that and migrating out into normal life, I just decided, you know what? Me and a couple of friends decided we should try this. We should try to start this company. So we named it Manna and failed for quite a while, tried to raise money. We ended up wandering around in Georgia because we thought we need to make large amounts of peanut butter, and surely, you know,
Georgia has lots of
peanuts.
They've
got a lot of peanut butters down there. So, and that's where we landed. We landed in South Georgia in Fitzgerald, Georgia. The town there took us in, and we built in the middle of a peanut field. We built a facility. We raised about $13 million overall.
How?
Wow, it was tough. Well, we failed for a long time. And then a great group out of Texas gave us our first million. And then the town of Fitzgerald wanted the jobs. And so the mayor there, mm-hmm. I always tell people he'd been the mayor for 47 years at that point when I met him, and he said we want the job. So we began to work with them on financing the building, and then a group called the Children's Investment Fund, which is in a way sort of like the Gates Foundation of England. Mm-hmm. They funded the rest of it.
So why are you also in Charlotte? If the peanuts are in Georgia and you built a plant in Georgia, why are you also in Matthews?
You know, those rocking chairs in the airport are pretty alluring.
So. Are you kidding?
Only partially so. Yeah, well, our team is from Dallas and from Los Angeles, California area, yeah. South of L.A. And we came here from Arkansas and from Colorado. Uh-huh. We needed a place to team up, and Charlotte's so much more livable than Atlanta. We just said, we can drive to the factory from Charlotte just as easily as we can.
So what goes on in the grist mill in Matthews? That's the administrative offices and the factory and the processing plant is in Georgia?
That's right. All the people who actually work are down in Georgia at our factory, and then there's six of us at the grist mill.
So you take the peanuts from Georgia and you make them into this RUTF, this ready-to-use therapeutic food, which is described as peanut paste. That sounds like peanut butter. Is it?
It is. It tastes like, I tell people it tastes like the inside of a Reese's peanut butter cup.
It's, that's good.
It is good. It's got quite a bit of sugar in it, and the sugar is there. Our nutritionists will have to excuse us for that, giving that to kids. But the sugar is just a very affordable way to get calories in it. And then the therapeutic milk. So you take the therapeutic milk. That's the real zinger there. That's got the lipids and... Yeah. And then there's a micronutrient mix, a vitamin mix.
Well, I'm going to open this and taste this in a second, but it does, as he says, Doctor, contain sugar. It contains, let's see here, sugar, roasted peanuts, and one or more of the following: canola, palm, and or soy oil, distilled monoglycerides, dry-hulled milk, and a vitamin-mineral mix. Now, we've had several people on this program talking about never eat anything with more than five ingredients and never eat anything you can't pronounce, like monoglycerides.
Right.
So talk to me as a nutritionist and a dietitian about these ingredients. Why do they need to be in here?
Well, first, I can't wait to see you eat the manna because I think it's going to be great for you. In defense of sugar in this case, I will say, you know, you have to have some sugar in a protein base to enhance absorption and utilization. And
really?
So small amounts of sugar aren't bad in this case. You know, it adds both calories, makes it more palatable for a child who's listless, who has no energy, who doesn't want to eat anything. But importantly, it does have a functional application for this food. And so that does help in the utilization and breakdown and use of protein.
And why do you need canola, palm, or soy oil in a product that has oil in it naturally? Peanut has oil in it naturally.
I think part of that is probably to make it more smooth and to add calories as well.
Talk to me about this, because this is clearly labeled for children with severe acute malnutrition. Talk to me about children who are severely malnourished.
Sure. There are a couple types of malnutrition, and let's talk about undernutrition, which is what we're talking about in the case of the folks who do receive manna and use it. In a couple of different situations, there may be extreme weight loss and then muscle wasting in very young children. When you have that, you don't have growth, you don't have development. In some of these developing countries where diets are primarily based on a single grain source like millet or corn, you can also see malnutrition.
So I think it was you in some of the materials that I read that talked about millet, because you hear about millet, that they have a lot of that around and they feed their kids that. And millet is what we use here as bird seed.
Right.
And there is no nutritional value.
Right. Very low.
Why then do they use it? Why do they have it?
It's available. It's available, and it grows under bad conditions.
It's a filler.
Exactly.
But these kids who are severely, acutely malnourished, they're not hungry anymore. They don't want to eat. They can't really move, can they? I mean, they're just kind of there.
Exactly. You know, and this even happens with the elderly who lose their appetites and fall into this spiral of undernutrition. You become disinterested in food. You become listless. You're conserving energy, and all of that becomes a real problem. And so something that's quick, simple, and palatable that also has, you know, great essential oils in it that do enhance the growth and development of children is great.
When we come back, I'm going to open this packet and we'll try to describe what it's like, what it tastes like, what it feels like, the mouthfeel of it. And we'll talk about how it's used, because it's not a permanent solution. It is a quick fix to a very bad problem. We'll come back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Live Nation, presenting Widespread Panic New Year's Eve at the Time Warner Cable Arena, Charlotte. Tickets available at livenation.com. Well, it's the time of year for holiday movies, and Oscar contenders are being released. And this year's choices, there's a wide range, actually, but they range from Big Hero 6 to the next Hunger Games series movie and a remake of the musical Annie to larger-than-life titles like Exodus, which just bombed over the weekend at the box office, and the last installment of the Hobbit series. And then there's smaller, more challenging films like Birdman out there. We're going to find out what our critics think is worth spending your holiday treasure on seeing, and they'll get together with us tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the House passed a spending bill that could cut pensions for a million workers, raise campaign donation limits, and roll back Wall Street reforms. What's at stake in the new budget bill?
Join the conversation on The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about severely malnourished children in other parts of the world who are being helped by a product that's manufactured in Georgia by a company, a nonprofit organization that is run out of Matthews. It's called Manna, and the product is ready-to-use therapeutic food, which is made out of peanuts. It is essentially a fortified peanut butter. Is that a good way of describing
it?
And our guests are Dr. Nancy Faye Jensen, who's the Dean of Health and Human Services at UNC Charlotte, and a dietitian and a nutritionist, and Mark Moore, who's the co-founder and CEO of Manna Nutrition. There are three words that we'll be using throughout this hour. They are hunger, malnutrition, and starvation. Define the difference.
Well, you know, malnutrition can be both overnutrition and undernutrition. And we'll talk about the overnutrition as this sort of, the sort of opposite of what we're talking about in terms of developing countries. But in undernutrition, you can have two different types. And with children, you might see you see protein-calorie malnutrition even when children have a consistent source of calories like millet or corn. And what you'll see is those are the kids with the distended bellies, with edema, with water collecting, because protein metabolism is so altered that it does affect their health that way. So they may look to be sort of, you know, normal weight, and they may in fact weigh in at normal weight, but they are severely malnourished. And then there is what we see on TV and what Mark experienced directly in Africa, and that is the acute and sometimes chronic starvation that occurs. That is the complete absence of food.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, folks can live without food for about a month. You can't live without water, but adults could live about a month without food. You become very conservative in your energy expenditures, but you are totally wasted. Muscle wasting occurs, and that's when you see these really, really painfully thin kids.
This pack of ready-to-use therapeutic food is about – it's my size of my hand. It's about the size of a phone, an iPhone or something, a smaller iPhone. Let me open this up here. There we go. And it's the color of peanut butter. Why should I be surprised by that? It's going to be kind of hard and sloppy to eat, but I'm going to try it. Here we go. Actually, it's the color of whiz cheese. And it tastes great. I mean, it tastes like peanut butter with not a little crunch to it, actually, and not as much consistency. It's looser than peanut butter is, but it's delicious.
Yeah, the kids love it. That's one of the great things about if you empower a mom with a packet of these. So what they do is these will be distributed through a development program, you know, Doctors Without Borders or mm-hmm. World Vision or the United Nations. Somebody would go in and work with a local ministry of health and get it to the moms, and the kids love it. They can feed themselves.
And this is designed to use for how long?
It goes for 6 weeks.
So
it's used in programs called CMAM programs mostly. And CMAM is community management of acute malnutrition. So it's a holistic approach.
So they're about 500 calories per pack. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
And they eat these three times a day.
Yep.
So that's 1,500 calories a day. How does that match a Western diet for kids?
1,500 calories a day? It's pretty close, you know. And it's such solid nutrition. It's packed into easily digestible amounts. It's easily administered, so mothers feel empowered. Children trust their mothers.
So
it works.
This helps them recover and gets them to what stage?
It gets them to a stage where their weight can stabilize, and then all other functions can start, you know, kicking back into full gear.
We're going to talk more about this, and we're talking about ways to address malnutrition in the third world by providing this ready-to-use therapeutic food. But some experts believe that it is the Western world that is causing this problem in the first place, and that there is a connection between the malnutrition we see in areas of extreme poverty and our own obesity epidemic. Raj Patel is a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. He joins us now for a few minutes. Dr. Patel, in your book, Stuffed and Starved, you write about the world food system, something you investigated to find out why half the world has abundant food while the other half starves. But you also found consumers in the abundant world are faced with what you call false food choices. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, what we have is a world where there are a billion people who are overweight and a billion people who are starving. And in the United States, we're presented often with a range of choices where we're choosing between things that are equally bad for us. We're choosing effectively between Coke and Pepsi. So imagine going down the supermarket aisle and, you know, in the cereal aisle, for example, you can be surrounded, you can be inundated with choice. But the choices that you're getting are choices that have been largely made for you by the supermarket, that have been made for you by the food processors. What you won't find are, you know, dozens of varieties of apple, for example, because most of the varieties of apple that we see in supermarkets today are cloned from ones that are good for transporting over long distances, that are available, that can be made available year round, rather than the kinds of apple that are fragile, that only do well in certain times of year or certain times of microclimate. And those kinds of choices, being able to choose between those kinds of apple, for example, well, you can't do that in the modern food system. So what you're faced with is a world where, on the one hand, it seems like we've got more choice than we can shake a stick at. You can have Coke with or without caffeine, with or without, you know, sugar, with or without half a dozen different things. But that choice is, in a sense, a false choice, when really what's left off the table is food that is good for us, that's local, that's seasonal, and that hasn't been processed.
Newsweek says that your book is a blistering indictment of the policies of multinational agribusiness conglomerates and charges that their drive for profit at any cost has left the developing world starving, while wealthy countries like us are experiencing epidemic obesity rates and related health problems. Is that the connection between the obesity epidemic here and starvation elsewhere that you see?
Well, I mean, I think, in a word, if we're interested in what the connections are between obesity and hunger, the word is poverty. And in fact, you can find obesity in some of the poorest places on Earth. I mean, I wrote the majority of this book when I was living in South Africa. And South Africa is a place where you can find both deep hunger and obesity, just like you can in the United States. I mean, people forget that, yes, you know, we have incredible rates of obesity in the United States, but we also have a situation where 50 million Americans are food insecure, and that which is to say that at some point during the year, people don't know where their next meal is coming from, not because they're, you know, skipping meals, but because they are too poor to be able to afford it. And that seems to be the common denominator around the world, that if you're poor in the United States, you don't get to have too many choices about what it is you get to eat. Mm-hmm. And the foods that are cheap in the United States are ones that are likely to make you overweight. But the trouble is, increasingly elsewhere in the world where there is poverty and where the industrial food system has reached, you also have these bad food choices. And so if you're poor, whether in the United States or elsewhere, your choices are either between food that is going to make you overweight, or if you're incredibly poor, you're not going to be able to afford food at all.
You point out that about four corporations control 50% of the food market, and as a result, they keep prices to farmers low around the world, and then they add salt and fat and sugar to make us in the West want to buy and eat more of what they're making, and that adds to the obesity problem, obviously. But how does it exacerbate the problem of starvation?
Well, so in every major market, there's a handful of corporations. I mean, the four corporations control the global grain market. But in every, I mean, and so it's Archer Daniels Midland, Bunge, Cargill, and Dreyfus are those corporations. But in every market, the power is cornered in the hands of just a few corporations. It's not the same four, and it's not, you know, sometimes it's five or six, sometimes it's two. But the idea here is that corporations are businesses. And what do businesses do? They buy cheap and sell dear. And when you're in the food business, you want to buy cheap. That means you're paying as little as you can for the food. And in developing countries, the people who get paid least, the people who are most likely to starve, are the people who grow food. Farm workers are, around the world, the population that's most likely to be starving. And when these corporations are driving down the price of grain, who do you think it is who gets the least money? It's going to be farm workers. And that's the rather direct connection between low prices for consumers and these powerful corporations driving down prices where the people least able to survive are farm workers. So, you know, you have this wicked irony where the people growing the food, the people out in the fields, are the people least able to be able to afford food.
And if I understand your research correctly, and I may be completely wrong on this, so please correct me if I am, what you're saying is that government policies in these poorer countries have been developed, actually, that end up helping these conglomerates, these food conglomerates, to the detriment of their farmers and their farmers' ability to grow food for themselves, their families, and their own local populations.
Well, that's right. And I think the tragedy is that it's also what's destroying family farming in the United States and in Europe and in the very countries that, that are writing these international trade rules like NAFTA or the World Trade Organization. You know, the United States and the European Union are, you know, leading the world and creating this regime of free trade. The trouble is that there's no such thing as free trade, particularly in agriculture. I mean, here in the U.S., we subsidize our agribusinesses to the tune of billions of dollars, and the same is true in the European Union. But the trouble is that small family farms, the kind of farms that you think about when you think about the prairie and people, you know, chewing on straw and leaning over a picket fence, those kinds of farms are being destroyed by these kinds of policies as well. So it's hurting farmers around the world, and I think that that's, I mean, that's the great tragedy, is that we're being sold this idea that, well, at least America and the small family farms in America are going to be here to feed the world. But it's, you know, if you listen to groups like the National Family Farm Coalition right here in the United States, you'll hear that they're as opposed to these kinds of free trade arrangements as are the small family farms in places like India.
Now let's talk more about free trade for a second, because you have a close-to-home example of what happened in Mexico as the result of NAFTA. And a lot of people in this country were very opposed to the North American Free Trade Agreement because they thought it was going to hurt us. But according to you, it has really hurt Mexicans, and particularly Mexican farmers. How?
Well, one of the provisions of NAFTA was that we would have free trade in agriculture. Now, as I've just mentioned, the United States subsidizes its agriculture, particularly its corn, to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars every year. Now, Mexican farmers don't have that kind of support. And in fact, the Mexican government itself said, look, our farmers are horribly backward, and you in America, you're very good at industrial corn production. So what we need to do is kick our farmers into the 21st century. And the way we're going to do that is by having U.S. corn come into Mexico and drive farmers out of corn production and into the cities, where they will get the jobs that will come down as a result of NAFTA from the United States to Mexico. That was the vision of both the U.S. and the Mexican government. And the trouble is, of course, that when this cheap corn flooded into Mexico, Mexican farmers couldn't make ends meet. And predictably, farming communities that were dependent on corn found themselves emptied, and people did migrate to the cities, and some then subsequently migrated to the United States because our corn was migrating down to Mexico.
You know, you take a look at the countries where starvation is a real serious problem, where kids are dying from malnutrition, and the West looks at that and sends food. We all send our money. The money buys food. The food goes to these people who are starving. But you say in those situations where we start sending stuff, we send the bad stuff. We send lots of corn and soy. Why is that bad?
Well, first of all, I mean, usually when there is hunger around the world, Mike, there's usually food in the, you know, in the district or in the region that's ready to be bought. Now, the trouble is that particularly with the U.S. food aid policy, but other countries do it too, but increasingly less. The U.S. is really the last country that really sticks to this idea. The idea is, well, here we are in America. We're going to feed the world. So let's send our corn quick as you can from Kansas on a U.S. ship to wherever it's needed. And the problem is that when that ship finally arrives, you take the corn off, and there are lovely bags that say "Gift of the People of the United States of America." But the problem is that you're giving away free food in an economy where the farmers are hanging on just by their fingernails. And what do you think happens when you give free food away to the in an economy where farmers desperately need some money to be able to survive? Well, those farmers go out of business. And those farmers find themselves with no market to sell whatever little grain they've been able to eke from the soil. And so the trouble is that with the best of intentions, it seems, U.S. grain can end up wiping out what's left of a farming economy in a place that desperately needs one.
So what's the what's the answer to this?
Well, the answer is to buy locally and regionally. And almost every country that engages in food aid and almost every charity and NGO has now agreed that actually the smart thing to do is buy from these farmers. I mean, the farmers have the food, and in the region, you can get food from, you know, from neighboring countries or from neighboring areas to bring into the affected area. And so you end up both encouraging a local economy, and you're able to stimulate farmers into more production, and you don't have to wait, you know, months for something to cross from Kansas, you know, from the United States to wherever it is that it's required. And most countries have kind of adopted that idea. It's just the United States is hanging on to this remnant of the Cold War, when in the Cold War it seemed like a good idea to find an outlet for surplus U.S. grain and surplus, you know, merchant navy capacity. But right now we don't have any of those constraints, but we're still hanging on to this policy like it's 1945.
Let me ask you one more question, and that is this. This has been going on for a very, very long time. So why is it just now that we've begun to notice a rapidly rising tide of obesity and a level of starvation in the rest of the world, the poorer parts of the world, that has never been worse?
Well, it's a couple of things. The levels of obesity really kick in the 1970s, and that's really when we see an incredible rise in the rate of ultra-processed food being sold around the world. You have new ingredients like high-fructose corn syrup being added like it's going out of fashion, and those kinds of ingredients are being pushed, and those kinds of processed foods really take off in the 1970s, and that's when you can trace the rise of epidemic levels of obesity. And when we see it around the world now, it's, you can usually attach it to some sort of change in the market where new foods are arriving in a country, and you see these processed foods being sold and heavily marketed, and all of a sudden you'll see a rise in the rates of diseases associated with poor diet. But the incredible levels of hunger are really about, I mean, the recent levels of hunger are about the recession. I mean, the reason people go hungry, and often people think, well, the reason people go hungry is because there's not enough food. That's nonsense. Right now, the reason people are going hungry is because of poverty. And the Great Recession has really kicked more people into poverty. And, you know, we're here in the United States where, as I say, 50 million people are food insecure. That number is an embarrassment, given that before the Great Recession, the number of people who were in who were food insecure was around 35 million. So from 35 to 50 million people at the end of the Bush presidency, and when the Great Recession started, that number jumped by 15 million. And globally, you see an incredible increase in the number of people going hungry. Again, not because there's an insufficient amount of food, but because of poverty.
Professor Raj Patel, a research professor at the Lyndon B. Johnson School of Public Affairs at the University of Austin, University of Texas at Austin, and the author of Stuffed and Starved. Thanks for the time.
Thank you, Mike. It's been a pleasure.
And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mark Moore, who's the co-founder and CEO of Manna Nutrition, and Dr. Nancy Faye Jensen, the Dean of Health and Human Services at UNC Charlotte, about some of the things that can be done and are in fact being done to help with this problem in the impoverished parts of the world and with overconsumption of food that still leaves children malnourished in this country. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Novant Health Cancer Care, offering multidisciplinary clinics where breast, prostate, GI, and lung cancer patients receive a comprehensive second opinion from a team of experts. Details at 704-384-5373. The House and Senate passed a spending bill that could cut pensions for a million workers, raise campaign donation limits, and roll back Wall Street reforms. What's at stake in this new budget bill? The topic of the conversation in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. You can join them for that. You can join our conversation as well. You can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, and we are coming right back. Thank you.
In 2014, WFAE brought you the news you counted on, and with your help, we're committed to doing the same in 2015. As 2014 draws to a close, please take a moment to make a tax-deductible contribution. Contribute before December 21st and be entered to win an Apple iPad Mini. No pledge is necessary, but we hope you'll choose to support the news that you depend on. Please call 704-549-9000 or make your gift online at WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Dr. Nancy Faye Jensen with UNC Charlotte and Mark Moore, the CEO of Manna Nutrition. They make this ready-to-use therapeutic food that we tasted about 20 minutes ago, which is essentially highly fortified and extra nutritious peanut butter that they give to children who are severely, acutely malnourished 3 times a day. It's 500 calories per packet. The kids love it because it tastes great. I will tell you that it tastes great. I'd eat this on a regular basis. And it's easy to store, easy to use. It requires nothing extra. You open the packet, you eat it. And it restores these kids to health. And then what happens to them?
Well, if you we're sitting at a table right here, and if you look at this table and were to take our phone or something, set it right on the edge, and it would be precariously placed on the edge, you know, where mm-hmm. if someone bumps the table, off goes the phone onto mm-hmm. the tile floor. But if you could move that phone to the center, then whatever environmental factors happen, the phone wouldn't fall off if the table got bumped. And that's the kind of environment these kids live in. If we move them to the center nutritionally, to where they're safe, they still get malaria, they still have problems. And some of the things Dr. Patel talked about still occur in their lives. But this puts them in a nutritionally stable place, but to where they can get, go
designed,
about their life.
This is designed for 6 weeks. So they got to a stage of severe malnutrition because of the conditions that they face in their world. We give them this for 6 weeks. It brings them up to a level where they're now healthier. They're no longer listless. They're building muscle tissue, and they've gotten their zest for life back. But then have we changed the food situation? Why wouldn't they fall back into that situation that got them to the point where they needed your product in the first place?
Well, before Nancy, I'll let her chime in on that. But so my analogy of being on the edge, if to move them away, we finally get them into a spot. These kids were born hungry to hungry moms in many occasions, and so we've put them in a place in life where they never have been before, and now they go back to normal diets. And there's also a process within this feeding program, the CMAM programs, of education of the moms to say, here are some better foods that you could get to your kids. You're getting to see this mom, for instance, every Monday, and giving them new packets for the week, having a weight check, talk to them about their situation. Mm-hmm. And so some of the data, there's a study out of the University of St. Louis, Washington University in St. Louis, that 94% of these kids don't come back.
Yeah.
So, it's a solution.
If the moms are hungry, because they're living in an impoverished situation with no food, what prevents them from eating this for self-preservation purposes? Why wouldn't they eat it? I'd eat it.
Well, they may try some, but if you eat it as an adult, I tried it one time. I ate it for about a month.
But you're not malnourished.
I'm not, but the adult palate, you start to eat the same thing over and over again.
You get bored with it.
They get pretty bored with it, and there hasn't been a black market developer that's been too serious about it.
But, you know, there's a social piece to that, and that is, even in the United States, parents will go without food to make sure that their children are nourished. It's a really interesting phenomenon. It happens in developing countries, and it happens right here in the U.S.
Mm. Talk to me about kids who have been severely malnourished, mm-hmm. and because of this product and products like it, they come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened to them physically? Has their growth been stunted? Has their brain development been stunted? Can they recover from that?
Right,
fully.
Right. Well, we talk about the importance of the first 3 years of life, really the first five, where growth and development are occurring at a very, very rapid rate. You know, if there's an impediment to that, if nutrients are scarce, if kids are prone to infection, and in developing countries, malaria and other issues are really prominent, they have no ability to fight that. You know, in a malnourished state or an undernourished state or an acute starvation state, there's just no way you're you're going to come out of any kind of infectious disease in a successful way. Importantly, this sets a platform for kids to build their immune system, and that's where that first 1,000 days is really important, first 3 years of life, mm-hmm. first 5 years of life, where immune systems are bolstered. They have the ability to live in a pretty precarious environment more successfully, and the education piece and the resource piece for these moms who are participating in the MANA feeding program is really essential. You know, helping them find other sources of food, to diversify the diet a little bit more so that the essential nutrients can be introduced and maintained in a child's diet, it's really, really essential.
How successful are you at being able to do that part of this puzzle piece?
Well, that piece of it is handled by local ministries of health and by delivery partners. So a Save the Children or a World Vision or a Doctors Without Borders would handle that, and they run those programs.
If I'm correct, Save the Children occasionally runs PSAs on television, public service announcements on television, that says it only costs, I don't know what they say, 50 cents a day to feed a child. And I always looked at that quizzically saying, how is that possible? It is possible because this product costs what?
This cost with three is about a dollar a day.
A dollar a day.
And back to, I think it's important to go back to Raj Patel's comments that if we intervene and say, hey, I want to feed your children, then the damages that he talked about so articulately begin to occur and begin into the cycle of dependence that we see in our own country that we don't want to foster. And so this product, he's right. We need to purchase foods locally. We need to get local farmers making this. And even making this product, it's possible with the right investment to begin to make it locally. There's some efforts.
Why don't you make it locally?
We'd love to in the future. We started here in the States, and there's some great people out there. We have a friend, Mark Maneri, is a good friend of ours who makes it locally in several countries, and there's mm-hmm. some great efforts underway to do it. Part of it is the scale to do it locally is tough. There's some food issues there on food safety.
Because you worked in the Senate, the United States Senate, as a legislative fellow, where you say you learned a little bit about food aid and how we do it, and what you described as the opportunities we have here as such a blessed country to use our extra food to assist those who at times struggle with food. Had you heard when you were in the Senate working with Mary Landrieu that the charges that Dr. Patel has levied, that our policies actually are hurting farmers and hurting the poor people that we then turn around and try to help with our bags of grain?
Oh, every day. Every day.
You heard that while you were in the Senate.
That debate is alive and well in the Senate.
Why is no one listening? Are they?
The Farm Bill, you know, there's a lot of – it's a whole show to talk about food policy in the Senate or in the U.S. government. But we just passed a new Farm Bill this past year, and – there are two sides of the coin. Part of it is food security for us in the United States, whether we like it or not, has become dependent. We've limited our farmers down. We don't have that many. And so to put a floor on the cost of grain, these farmers, we can't let them go out of business here in the United States. So an argument of that side, a proponent of that side of the food aid argument would say, hey, we need – the USDA needs to step in and provide a floor for our farmers. And then we end up owning all this grain. We own all this stuff. So we got to do something with it. But you're right, we could be smarter about the way. And part of it, this is an example. This is a value-added product where we don't just dump bags of grains and of soy or whatever, that we add some value there. We put some vitamins in it. It's fortified. It becomes the perfect solution for a specific problem, not to feed the whole world.
Yeah, because you say it's not for every kid. In fact, it's not even the best solution for every hungry kid. You say that people, hungry children, hungry people, need better agriculture, better jobs to buy their own food, and better governments.
That's right. This is it's a middle ground almost between medicine and food. For these kids who are severely acutely malnourished, they've got weeks to live. Yeah. So this is an intervention that puts them back on a path to life.
Dr. Patel wanted me to ask you both this question, so I will ask it. He said he would really be interested in hearing the answer. Why is your product, this, what's it called, ready-to-use therapeutic peanut food, better than breastfeeding? Because he says there's no better way to fight hunger and malnutrition in small children mm-hmm. than breastfeeding.
If I can weigh in on that, I mean, I'm kind of flashing back to the 70s when we were protesting Nestle going into developing countries and introducing infant formula into cultures where breastfeeding was pretty much the standard until the next child came along, and sometimes two children were being breastfed at once. Breast milk is a perfect food, and even women who are undernourished can produce breast milk that is a fairly high quality that will promote that growth and development we just talked about, Mike, and in a really great way. When you introduce formula and other kinds of things, generally speaking, in situations where water quality is poor. This is what happened in the 70s and why we protested so rigorously. You're introducing pathogens into a child's diet, and the formulas weren't as good as breast milk. Now they've improved a great deal. What this product is, it isn't a substitute for breastfeeding, but once a child is weaned, they are at very, very high risk of infection, malnutrition, undernutrition, and even starvation, particularly as subsequent children come along. And so this, you see it all the time in developing countries where the first and second children are weaned and they just fall into the throes of chronic malnutrition and frequently die.
This is actually a good product, I'm told. What you're sending to Africa is a good product for a lot of the children in this country who live in poverty but who are obese, because there is this connection that we heard from Dr. Patel and earlier in our conversation with the two of you, that it's kind of the same side of two sides of the same coin. Malnutrition can be framed as both undernutrition with inadequate calories and protein and other essential nutrients, and as overnutrition, overconsumption of calories with the lack of all those things. Talk about that.
Right. A real problem in the Western world, you know, in developed countries. And we're bringing our own brand of malnutrition, as Raj alluded to and is so articulate about, to developing countries.
So when you're fat because you're eating a diet of soft drinks and Cheetos,
mm-hmm.
you're full, but you're getting nothing.
Absolutely. We call those empty calories. And, you know, calories are important. We need to eat. But we need to get back to basics. And, you know, he talked about the architects of the food system. And these architects of the food system are large corporations. They are folks who have monetary interests in mind. They are promoting products that are not health-promoting. And so these false choices that Raj and others talk about, Marion Nestle from NYU is a food policy expert, and she speaks about this a lot, where, you know, farm commodities can dictate food policy in the United States and may, in fact, do that in other countries. And so pushing grains versus fresh fruits and vegetables, which is a turn that we could take in the United States to really stem the tide of obesity, you know, agriculture needs to turn its attention to more nutrient-dense foods. I'm not saying grains are bad. I'm just saying they're too pervasive in our diet.
One of the problems with fresh fruits and vegetables is shelf life.
Right.
And a lot of people in this country who are malnourished, but who are also obese, live in food deserts where the only thing they can get, pardon the expression, is crap.
Right.
They can't eat. They don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. And if they did, they can't afford for it to go bad.
Right.
So what's the alternative there?
Well, we've got a lot of work to do in both rural and urban areas where there are food deserts. The unfortunate part of food deserts in a city like Charlotte, for example, is that there are plenty of fast food outlets out there where people can buy all kinds of calories. And so then you've got this four-part magic that happens for the fast food industry. You've got food that's easy to get. You can walk up to a window or drive up to a window. It's delicious because they've engineered it to taste good and feel good in your mouth and to smell amazing. It's cheap and it's abundant. So when you have those four things going on and you can buy 3,000 calories for $2.50 in the United States, you know, that's where the paradox of obesity and poverty really comes from. Just one example.
The USDA has a food safety net program, several food safety net programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance or SNAP food stamp program. They have school lunch programs, breakfast programs. Talk about some of these and give us your take on whether we're helping or hurting.
Right, right. Well, what we really want is for people to be self-sufficient, to be able to have food choice and to be able to govern what their families are eating. This gets back to the false choices, you know, where marketing and advertising so influence what people think they want. Whoever asked for a pink cornflake? I go back to the 70s when I think about the first, you know, colored cereals that were coming out, or the 60s. And none of us ever asked for these things. Food scientists thought these things up and created need. And so we really, as Raj said, went awry really in the 60s and 70s.
It came out when color television came out.
Yeah.
It's true. Because kids could see the colors in the cereal boxes, and they wanted them.
Yeah, there you go. So we do have the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, otherwise known as food stamps. Mm-hmm. That serves that 50 million hungry people that Raj was alluding to, which is unconscionable. The problem with food stamps is it needs to be kind of re-engineered because it only provides a very small supplement. It's not meant to cover all food costs for all low-income families, but it's a little bit of a boost. Mm-hmm. So it's based on the assumption that we spend about one-third of our total income on food, which in today's economy isn't quite true. We need to spend a little bit more.
I'm going to go back to manna here. You can produce 46,000 pounds of this peanut paste a day. You've made 36 million packets this year alone. What does it cost, and who foots the bill?
Well, we sell it. So tenders come out from agencies that need it. So the USAID buys quite a bit. UNICEF buys it, and it costs about 33 cents a packet, roughly, so about a dollar a day, and we make a box of 150. So these little packets about the size of an iPhone go in a box, and then they're shipped. And I would make a quick comment. On the back of our package, it says best breastfeeding is best. So we're
Really? Is it on there?
It may not be on that one, but it's on all the new packets.
Okay.
And I wanted to make sure I said that. And I also wanted to say that it's probably not what kids here in the United States might need just because it has been designed by nutritionists as an exact profile for what a malnourished kid would need in Africa. But something like it could really take off.
Now, yours is a peanut-based problem, and in this country, at least, we have a lot of kids who can't even be near a peanut. Is that not a problem in the third world?
It's not. They don't have peanut allergies in the developing world, and there's a whole lot of conversation around why that is, but yeah, there are no allergies outside of us in Canada for the most part.
I'm sure that you need more money to keep this going. You're a nonprofit.
We do. We're a nonprofit. We take donations, right. But we appreciate that.
Mark Moore is a co-founder and CEO of Manna Nutrition. They make these ready-to-eat, ready-to-use therapeutic food packets that bring 1,500 calories a day into the lives of severely, acutely malnourished children around the world. And Dr. Nancy Faye Jensen is Dean of Health and Human Services at UNC Charlotte. Thank you both for being here. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.